A couple of you came in during worship, so let me reintroduce myself. My name is Glenn Davis. I am the campus pastor of Chi Alpha here at Stanford University. If you do not have a handout, would you please raise your hand so that someone can get you one? Everybody get one of those? Great. Oh, there's some over here who don't have one. Could you guys take care of that? Thank you very much. We frequently will do our teachings in Chi Alpha in themes. And the first few weeks of the fall quarter, I would like to take a look at the book of Psalms. The book of Psalms is a book of ancient Hebrew worship songs, and it is the largest book in the Bible. It has 150 chapters, and when you open your Bible straight to the middle, the Psalms is right at the heart of it. Now, that is in many ways just an accident of the way that the book was put together, but I think it is profoundly metaphorical. In the Psalms, we find very much of the heart of God and very much the heart of someone who is hard after God. And so I think that looking at the Psalms will serve us well as we seek to get oriented to spiritual life here at Stanford. So our first few weeks, we're going to talk about putting a song in our heart, specifically some of the great psalms of the faith. And I think the most appropriate place to begin is in Psalm number 1. And so, I don't know if you guys ever read Lord of the Rings or saw the movie. I've been a Tolkien fan for ages. In fact, the first book I remember reading and loving was The Hobbit. And from that man, I heard that he had written another book. I dove right into the Lord of the Rings, and it changed my world. In fact, to this day, my favorite genre of recreational reading is fantasy followed by science fiction. I just love reading that stuff. I eat it up. And there's this quote from The Lord of the Rings that really stands out to me as I was thinking about this psalm. Bilbo used to say to Frodo, "It's a dangerous thing, Frodo, going out your door. You step onto the road, and if you don't keep your feet, there's no knowing where you'll be swept off to. It's a dangerous thing stepping out your door. You put your foot on the road, and God only knows where you're bound." I don't know if that's been your experience in life, but it's certainly been mine. Anybody here make a wrong turn? I've made many wrong turns in life. In fact, this is only my third year doing ministry here at Stanford, the beginning of my third year. And my first year, I was here, and I was going to pick Andrew Wright up, who's the PowerPoint dude tonight, over at the end of the desk and do the turnabout. And I could not find it to save my life. If you haven't seen my car, it is this screaming yellow Ford Focus. And Andrew sat there, and he watched me drive by like five times the front of Escondido, trying to get down there, until finally, I think he called me on my cell phone and said, "Glenn, is that you or a taxi cab that I see?" And beckoned me down. Always making wrong turns. This summer, I was in Baltimore, and I was there to serve in a friend's wedding. He was getting married, and I got there a few days early because I wanted to enjoy the D.C. Baltimore area, and I had a meeting up in Annapolis. I was supposed to hook up with this guy, talk to him about how to do ministry to college students. He had to cancel because of some last-minute stuff, and so I found myself in Baltimore with nothing to do. So I called a few friends, and I found out that there's actually this really quirky kind of tourist attraction in Baltimore, the Edgar Allan Poe House. I don't know if you guys are Poe fans, you know, quote the Raven, Nevermore. And so I thought that would be kind of cool to go visit the Edgar Allan Poe House. And he's like, "Yeah, it's near the University of Maryland." Okay, so I found the University of Maryland on a map, drove over there, and I figured there'd be signs up, you know, there'd be some way to figure out where it was. And I found this sign that said, "Edgar Allan Poe's tomb, this way." So I parked my car, you know, paid outrageous amount for parking, walked over, and I found the tomb of Edgar Allan Poe. And it was, you know, kind of cool, right next to the university. But it said, "The Edgar Allan Poe House is 2 miles this way. Follow the signs." And I thought, well, this is kind of a cool tomb. Maybe I'll go see the signs. And so I'll go see the house. And so I start walking down the road. And as I start following the road, I notice there's a rather large interstate right in front of me with a crosswalk. Who's ever seen an interstate with a crosswalk? And so I make my way across. And on the other side of the interstate, the quality of housing changed dramatically. I went from being in, you know, kind of a rich kid school to the hood. I was deep in the hood. And I saw people were staring at me like, "What is this crazy dude doing here walking by himself? Is he nuts?" And so I started to see people, you know, lots of people out in front of their doorsteps, you know, drinking, you know, throwing back 40s and these little gangs, and probably literally gangs of rather large young men with alarmingly huge muscles. And so I just have this philosophy. When in doubt, be bold. So I picked the biggest, strongest looking dude I could find. I walked up to him and I said, "Hey man, you know where the Edgar Allan Poe House is? I'm trying to find it." He's like, yeah, man. You head this way, you turn that and there, and boom, there it is." And I felt really good. You know, I've proved something to myself. I'm not a coward. I'm courageous. I'm like, "Yes!" And as I start to walk, he says, "Yo man, yeah, you shouldn't be walking around here by yourself. I don't walk around here by myself. That ain't safe." Oh, I started to feel bad. But I was just too humiliated to turn back. So I started walking. Now, he gave me good directions, but I misunderstood them. And so I'm walking, and I was supposed to turn left. I go straight, and I'm seeing no sign of the Edgar Allan Poe House. And I'm starting to, now, if you've ever read Poe, he's like a horror writer. And so these Poe story, the cask of Amontillado, all this stuff's going through my mind. For the love of God, Montressor. Yes, Montressor. For the love of God. Ah! And so I'm just having these nightmare scenarios flow through my head. Three times on the way to the house, I had people stop me and say, what are you doing walking around here? Are you insane? I finally get to the house. There is a cop car parked out front. I find out there's always a cop car parked out front. They find it easier to respond to the crimes if they base out of the Edgar Allan Poe house. Ah, so I knock on the door. Like 19 locks there. The store opens it with, you know, okay, come in. Where's your car? Oh, I walked here. You walked here? Oh, man. Quote the Raven, nevermore. Never again am I going to walk to the Edgar Allan Poe house from the University of Maryland. That was just nuts. By the way, it's a dump. Edgar Allan Poe, not a wealthy man. Wrong turns. Now, I was fortunate. I was very fortunate. That story very well could have ended tragically. There was a reason all those people were telling me, you should not be here. And when we walk down the wrong road, awful things can wind up happening to us. And that's God's message for us here at Stanford. We need to be careful which road we walk down. And now I'm speaking metaphorically. And that is the thrust of Psalm 1. Be very careful which road you put your feet to in life, because the way you go will determine where you end up. So I'm going to read Psalm 1 to you, and then we're just going to break it down kind of line by line, section by section, and talk about how it's relevant to our lives here at the farm. And I'm reading from the New Revised Standard Version. I should probably say something before I get in. I'm not like a particular version junkie. The NRSV, the NIV, the CEV, the NLT, I know translations you've never even heard of. And as long as they do a faithful job of bringing the sense of the Greek, Hebrew, or Aramaic into English, I'm happy. I'll use the King James from time to time. I'm very flexible. Today, I chose the New Revised Standard Version. And it reads like this. Happy are those who do not follow the advice of the wicked, or take the path that sinners tread, or sit in the seat of scoffers. But their delight is in the law of the Lord. On His law they meditate day and night. They are like trees planted by streams of water, which yield their fruit in its season. And their leaves do not wither, and all that they do, they prosper. The wicked are not so, but are like chaff that the wind drives away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. But the way of the wicked will perish. The point of the psalm is very, very simple. There are two roads you can walk down, the path of the wicked or the path of the righteous. And which road you walk down will make all the difference. To paraphrase a well-known poem. So how can you tell which road you're on? One road leads to life, one road leads to death. One road leads to success, one road leads to destruction. How can we know that we're on the right road? Well, the psalm is very specific and helpful in the advice that it gives us. And basically, we can just take the first few statements that it makes and convert them into analytical questions for our own life and sort of give ourselves a survey, a test, an assessment to figure out where we're at. So on the back side of the psalm, I've got some questions for you. And just as I'm walking along, just think to yourself, if you prefer, feel free to write stuff down. If that makes you feel weird, like some, by the way, if you see your neighbor looking at you, just take your pen, poke them in the eye. They won't do it again. It's all safe here. But if you want to write down, feel free. The psalmist starts off, happy are those. Some translations say blessed. In case you didn't know, one of the biblical words for blessed, is equivalently translated happy. It's the happiness that results from being in a good state of being. Like Bill Gates is probably happy because he's stinking rich. No guarantee of that. Some rich people are very miserable, but if he's happy because of his wealth, it's a caused happiness. It's not like a fake happiness. Blessed is a caused happiness. Happy are those who do not follow the advice of the wicked, or take the path that sinners tread, or sit in the seat of scoffers. So the first question is, are you happy? Now, of course, none of us is happy all the time. And I hope none of you is bummed all the time. That's not what this psalm is talking about. What it's talking about is, what's your equilibrium point? What's the default position you return to after the stresses of the day or the absurd elational feeling of him or her saying, yes, I'll go out with you, whatever it is that got you way high or way low. After that's gone and it's you in your room at night, you're going to bed, are you basically happy or are you basically sad? It's not proof, but it's evidence. In other words, the Bible says again and again in many different ways that the default position of those who are in good relationship with God ought to be a general sense of pleasure and satisfaction with life. Whether their outward circumstances are good or bad, like Paul said, I've learned the secret of being content in any and all circumstances. Paul later said, or elsewhere said, the joy of the Lord is our strength. The default position of someone who's in close relationship with God ought to be pretty good. You ought to be generally happy and pleased with life, even if things suck right then. That should be your default position. If that's not your default position, you should take a step back and analyze yourself. Why might that not be the case? Now, I do want to say one thing. I'm not referring to those who suffer from clinical depression. That's a disease. If you have or you think you might have clinical depression, please talk to me. Talk to one of the advisors here on campus. There are professional resources you can get that can help you out. But I'm just talking about if you're an Eeyore, you know? I don't know. Maybe. You might want to try and plug into that Joy of the Lord thing. It works. Trust me. But you say, I'm not happy. I feel discontent with this, that, or the other. I'm not as smart as the other kids here at Stanford, or this person has a better scholarship than me, or they're prettier than me, or they have a better boyfriend, whatever. I don't know. Whatever is bumming you out, that's probably just surface level. If it's a consistent bum, there's probably something deeper than that. And the psalmist tells us what it is. Those who are not happy are those who follow the advice of the wicked, take the path that sinners tread, or sit in the seat of scoffers. Huh? That's weird. What does that mean? Different translations word it different ways. I will give you the sense of a different translation. I think the NIV puts it this way. Happy are those who do not walk the path of the wicked or walk in the counsel of the wicked, who do not stand in the way of the sinners, and who do not sit in the seat of the scoffers. Those who do not walk, stand, sit. Visualize this with me. You're going across campus. You wake up, you take a shower, deodorant. I hope for your sake you use deodorant. I hope for your neighbor's sake you use deodorant. You put on your backpack. You're walking across campus. You see someone. Oh yeah, we were in some advising group together. Hey Mindy, how's it going? Great. You're talking. You're walking along. Pretty soon she needs to go to chem lab. You got to go to math. You split your separate ways. A very superficial connection. You just walk together. Now you're walking along. You see Bobby. Bobby, how you doing, man? You start getting conversation, you stop walking, you're talking, you're there, you're planted. And then 15 minutes later, oh man, I'm late for class, gotta run, boom. That's a more prolonged relationship, right? And then, you know, you see someone, hey Nick, let's do lunch. Let's go sit down in the coho sometime. Dude, 2 hours fly by, you've had a deep, meaningful conversation. In other words, what the psalm is describing here is a progression of intimacy in relationship. In fact, it's advising, sort of encapsulating a very specific type of progression that can go on in our lives. Starts off with those who follow the advice of the wicked. That deals with belief. In fact, if you don't mind, go ahead and, if you have a pen, circle the phrase on your paper, follow the advice, and right off to the side, beliefs. We move from beliefs to behavior. We take the path, circle that phrase, take the path, off to the side, behavior. Belief drives behavior. And then finally, we're sitting in the place, or sitting in the seat, circle that phrase, of scoffers, off to the right, belonging. We move from belief to behavior to belonging, and we get further and further away from God's plan for our life, the place where we will find maximum fulfillment in our existence as we discharge our assigned function on this little blue ball, third rock from the sun. Belief, behavior, and belonging. It's a pretty standard progression. It works both in Christianity too. You move from sort of a mental ascent to starting to actually flesh things out in your life, taking action, and you finally find a community of faith, you plug in, and you really begin to take off in your faith. You shoot up like a plant in season. So what would it look like to follow the advice of the wicked? Here at Stanford, what would be some of the lies you could believe that would begin to lead you astray? Well, here's a couple that just occurred to me as I was reflecting on this. You know, all religions are the same. In case you haven't picked it up, that's a very popular perspective to adopt here at Stanford. And the thing is, it's rarely actually argued for. It's just presented so frequently from professors, from peers, from everywhere, that you begin to just soak it up by osmosis. See, here's the law of influence. I think about what I'm repeatedly exposed to. And what I repeatedly think about, I wind up doing. That is true, I promise you, a million times over. What I'm repeatedly exposed to, I think about. What I repeatedly think about, I wind up doing. And so, as we're listening to the advice of those, now I'm not saying, by the way, you should never get advice from non-believers. You know, if your car is broken and there's a mechanic who's like, you know, just a raw pagan, listen to them. I'm talking about advice about life, about relationships, about religion, about God. If you start taking advice from the wrong source, it's going to lead you down a wrong path. All religions are the same. Sex is no big deal. Oral sex is no big deal. It's not even sex. In fact, hooking up is the way normal people at Stanford have relationships. It's just a little fun is all. There's no harm involved. There are no victims here. Pornography. It's a victimless crime. It's no big deal. Do it. Here's one. We're privileged and we're better than other people. We're smarter than other people. Therefore, we deserve to receive preferential treatment in every area of life. We deserve to be served. We deserve to be served with excellence, and so much so that we develop an entitlement mentality, so that if someone delivers us less than sterling performance, we write an angry letter to the Stanford Daily talking about how horrible it is that we have to pay 1 cent more than we think the optimum price is for you know, Wheaties at the Coho or something. And if you haven't looked at the Stanford Daily yet, you will find a lot of letters like that. People have begun to believe, wow, I'm the center of the universe. How does a Stanford student change a light bulb? They hold the bulb up and the room revolves around them. Don't let it happen to you. It starts with belief. When you receive bad belief, you almost inevitably will move on to bad behavior unless you take the Bible's advice and take these thoughts captive and make them obedient to Christ. You move down the road and you start to engage in bad behavior. Have a good evening. Start to engage in bad behavior. What might that look like? Well, maybe you move beyond taking bad advice to actually beginning to dabble in some things that just violate some deep convictions of yours. You're not really like, you know, hardcore, but you're starting to fool around. You start merely rationalizing about pornography to actually watching it without real sense of guilt or shame. You've stopped thinking, you know what, maybe this stance that I was taught in my church about substances is not really, I mean, the law should be different, therefore, and you start actually engaging in wrong behavior. And what winds up happening is you have a problem on your hands. You see, if you have a faith in God, then you have this sense of I shouldn't be doing this. And so you have a choice. Either I deal with the thing or I deal with the faith. In other words, either I decide to stop doing that thing and turn away from it, or I decide to adjust my faith in such a way that it no longer bothers me. Very popular option. And you, as you do that, it becomes easier and easier to walk down the wrong road. And eventually, now, and you say to yourself, by the way, it's so small, it's no big deal. And most of my life, I'm living right, I'm doing good, I'm actually pleased with my relationship with God. I'm having a good devotional life, I'm doing this or that, I'm going to church regularly, whatever your little measuring stick is for spirituality. You're getting a 90%. Hey, that's an A, right? Have you guys, anybody here born Halloween in 1983, perchance? I didn't think so. It was unlikely. But have you guys ever heard of South Korean Airlines Flight 007, Korean Airlines 007, out of Anchorage, Alaska? They took off out of Anchorage, flying direct flight to Seoul, South Korea. But there was a glitch in the navigational system. Small, 1.5 degrees. Pilot didn't notice that. I mean, you take off, you know, you're flying over the same buildings you always fly over. And then you get further away, you know, 100 miles out. The landscape looks the same from a couple thousand feet up, you know. And then you're over the ocean for so long. I mean, what, you know, oh, wow, that's a different way than I was expecting. I mean, you got no way to know. But when he showed up on Soviet radar, the Soviets noticed very quickly. And they scrambled MiG jets. And they shot the flight down. And every person on board died. Why? 1.5 degrees off. It was a small alteration in trajectory that had a massive consequence for the course of their lives. Don't dabble. Even if it seems small, when you start pursuing the way, just convincing yourself, rationalizing, and then doing, you wind up in a bad place. You probably won't be shot down by MiGs, but bad things will happen in your life. Your spiritual health will deteriorate rapidly. Finally, you wind up in this place of belonging. You wind up in this place where you're more allied with those who would consider themselves rebels against God or mockers of God or, you know, whatever phrase, you know, those are kind of negative terms from the Christian side, you know, free thinkers, atheists, you know, or what do they call themselves now, brights. Whatever side, you know, you find yourself more in that camp than on the God camp, and you get further and further away, and you find yourself alone from God. You find yourself isolated, and you find yourself, finally, unhappy. In a very profound way. I mean, things may be even going well for you. You graduate from Stanford. You got a good job. You got a good spouse. You've got kids who are doing well, maybe getting to Stanford themselves someday, you know, Oxford, who knows. Things are going well, but you're living a life of quiet desperation. You're very hollow and empty on the inside, and you know what the problem is deep down inside, but it's too humiliating for you to deal with it. And you're stuck in the seat of the scoffer. This is why, by the way, the selection of your friends here at Stanford is so vital. How important are your friends? Let me do a quick pop quiz. I actually want interaction on this. I want you to actually raise your hands. Has anyone here ever temporarily abandoned a conviction at the urging of a friend? I have. Raise your hand. If you've ever temporarily just done something you thought was wrong because a friend sort of urged you on to do it. I've done it many times. When you were a minor, did you ever deliberately disobey your parents so your friends would think you were cool? I did that a lot. Growing up, man, that was the story of my teenage years. How many of you have ever deliberately not done something you know God was prompting you to do, either by express command in His Word or through the inner leading of the Holy Spirit? You knew He wanted you to do it, but you were afraid it would make you look like a dork to your friends, and so you didn't. I've done that. Your friends matter. Your friends matter a great deal. Your friends will determine the direction and the quality of your life here at Stanford and for the rest of your life. The people who are closest to you. Now, I'm not saying don't make friends with what this passage calls the wicked, which, by the way, I hope you understand. This is hyperbole being used by the Bible. It's not saying that every person who is not like an active follower of God is like Hitler. It's just saying there are two roads, and this is the road that, for example, Hitler walked down, and it may not look like it, but you're following his trajectory in a more subtle way. And it's not saying you're righteous to your Mother Teresa. It's saying this is the sort of path that she walked down. And even though you may not fully manifest it as she did, you're still moving in that direction. The second derivative of your life, you're focus up, focus down. You're moving in that sort of direction. How'd you like that? The math geeks are like, yeah! I try to make the Bible relevant to today's geeks. It's the geek English version. Today's geek version. So your friends are vital. That's why it's so important. It's super, super important that you find and commit to a community of faith here at Stanford. Again, Chi Alpha would love to be that to you. If we're just not your thing, find someone. I beg you, find someone. And make your deepest friendships there. Now, I'm not saying don't be friends with people who aren't Christians. That would be whacked. That's not Jesus at all. That's not at all my advice. What I'm saying is we all know that we've got hierarchies of relationship. There are those who are really close to us, who shape us on the deepest level, whose approval we crave, and whom, in many cases, we would do almost anything for. It's very important that you like who those people are, because you will become more like them, and they will become more like you. That's the group I'm talking about. You got plenty of friends, plenty of acquaintances. By all means, be salt and light here at Stanford. Make as many friends as you can. But those closest to you, let them be people who you want to become more like at the deepest, most profound, most spiritual level. That's one road. And that road leads to death. What's the other road? What does that look like? Well, the psalmist goes on. Their delight, the happy's delight, is in the law of the Lord. And on His law, they meditate day and night. Now, notice, by the way, this starts in the exact opposite place of the way of the unhappy. In other words, it starts with belief, but positive belief. Not taking bad advice, but good advice from God. Their delight is in the law of the Lord. They meditate on His law day and night. Belief drives behavior. What you expose yourself to is so vital. And when you begin to delight yourself in the law of the Lord, it's not hard to fulfill His law. You discover that Jesus' yoke is easy and His burden is light, as He promised. And that living life according to God's plan is actually better. Not just psychologically, but empirically in your life. And that things go well for you. And we look at that a little bit later in this psalm. But I want to start with asking you, do you delight in God's law? Let me admit, that is a tough one for me. Now, some parts of the Bible is pretty easy to delight in. Woohoo! David beat Goliath, way to go! Walking on water, yeah, I'm all about that! Raising from the dead, yes! Forgive those who deliberately and maliciously hurt you. Booyah! You know, be kind and forgiving. Walk the extra mile. It's hard to, you know, do a dance. You know, you don't find a lot of worship songs about that. You can tell a lot about the state of the church theologically, at its deepest level, by the way, by looking at what songs are popular. And they change over time, not just decade by decade, but century by century. And right now, man, I have to say, we tend to be a pretty superficial bunch. We don't deal with the whole canon of Scripture. In fact, most of the psalms in this book that we're studying right now, if someone was to sing them in your church, you'd be very upset. You would not be happy at all. We don't appreciate the richness of the context in which we can worship God. But delighting in God's law. So how can we do that if it's hard for us? Well, the psalmist gives us specific advice. By meditating on His law day and night. That sounds fancy, meditation. There's classes you can take here like in Palo Alto. $300, learn how to meditate. I'll give you the 30-second version. It's simple. You want to know how to meditate? Think about something again and again and again. That's all it is. That's all meditation means. So, for example, when you're sitting in your dorm room and you listen to whatever the current hit single is, you know, like last year, Hey Ya by Outkast, Shake It Like a Polaroid, you know, again and again And again, whatever the top 40 song is, it just goes on incessantly on the radio. You're meditating on that song, whether you realize it or not. You're running it through your mind again and again and again. Same thing with God's law. If you just think about it again and again and again, it will begin to form grooves in your mind, like water cutting a channel. It will etch itself in there, and you will find that your thought patterns actually change. And you will find yourself taking on the mind of Christ and adopting God's perspective on your everyday problems. And so meditate on God's law. Well, but that's hard. There's so many things. Let me tell you what it could look like. It's very, very simple. I'm not saying you need to spend 20 hours up on some, pillar somewhere, Om Mana Padme, thinking of, no. You wake up in the morning. Remember the early scenario. You wake up in the morning, you see your friend. Same thing. You wake up in the morning, shower, shave, if that's your gender or whatever, or you're just very unfortunate. You start heading across campus. And you got a choice. You can begin thinking, oh man, okay, so got to get to class, and then I got to go check my mail, and I've got to talk to Susie about how Thursday night's party was, and boom, boom, boom. And you can just, your mind can get filled. Or you can just say, you know what, God? It's a 5-minute walk, but it's what I have right now. I'm going to give it to you. And so you begin to meditate on God's law. Doesn't mean you haven't memorized word perfect. You're walking with a Bible in your hand. It just means you've got some concepts now. You begin to meditate on it. For example, tonight. Tonight's theme is there are two roads. The road of the righteous, the road of the wicked. You begin to think about it. You're just like, God, you say there's two roads. Can't there be more than two roads? That seems a bit arbitrary to me. Unless what you're talking about is something like a centered set where I'm either moving closer to the apex, to the center of something, or I'm moving further away. Maybe I'm moving tangential to it, but I'm still moving away from it. It's something very fundamental and directional. Okay, so there are two roads. I'm either getting closer or further away. The only way I'd be stationary is if I was in orbit. So, okay, there's two roads. I'm moving down. That could make sense. But it says the way of the wicked leads to destruction. You know, God, I know some pretty nasty people who are having a pretty good life. They seem pretty happy. You say, happier those who live life your way. You know what? I'm not always happy when I live your ways. That makes sense to me. Well, you know what? All my friends are like 18. Maybe it's possible that after I've lived this way for 60 years, it will have a different effect on me than after I've lived this way for just a few. In fact, that seems likely. Wow. Maybe this is advice from people older and wiser than me that I should heed in my youth. What a concept. And you begin to think these things through. It's like, whoa! Incidentally, why are you coming here to Stanford? Because you're paying a ton of money to get advice from people older and wiser than you. Isn't that it? To have them ratify your learning and your ability. Take that mentality in all of life. I just urge you. There's a wealth of wisdom all around you can just suck dry from and avoid a lot of major mistakes. But that's meditating. In other words, as you begin to meditate on it, you run it through your mind, you think about it from different angles, pro, con, maybe this, maybe that. As you do that, it begins to make more and more sense to you, and you're actually able to delight in it. Because it's something that you believe. It's like you start with, you say, don't lust. What's so wrong with lust? Lust, you wired me this way. Why should I have these emotions and these hormones? And you begin to reflect on it and meditate. You run it through your mind again and again and again. You toss it around like a philosophy major. You meditate on this scripture, that story, this experience in your life, and you come to this place where all of a sudden you have this light bulb goes on. Lust twists me on the inside. It becomes addictive. It releases, actually, in case you're curious, epinephrine in my brain. And that becomes like a drug to me. And I crave it, and it becomes consuming, and it distracts me from doing things that are more important. And it gets in the way of true love when true love comes my way, because someday I want to be happily married. And I don't want to be in the habit of lusting after everything on two legs I see that I think looks fine. Because that habit does not go away just because I put a ring on my finger. And if I want to be happily married then, I need to exercise some discipline now. Bang, it makes sense. And you can delight in the law of the Lord. It's still hard sometimes. There's a Russian proverb that comes to mind though. The church is far and the road is icy. No, the church is close and the road is icy. The bar is far, but we will walk carefully. You make your way towards the things that are important to you. If you really want to learn to meditate on God's law, it'll take a while. You'll start and you'll get real good. Your first 100 yards out of the dorm. Yeah, baby, I'm thinking about, take captive every thought, this, that, the other. And then, all of a sudden you're like, whoa, did you see her? And, you're like, oh man, God, I'm sorry, I totally forgot. Next day you make it 200 feet. Or maybe 90. You go one step forward, two steps back, but you keep doing it. And after a few weeks you find that regularly you get to the point where the first thing you think in the morning is about how great God is and how wonderful His law is in your life and His guidance. And you're so grateful for the fact that He gives you practical advice that makes a difference here at Stanford. I submit that to you as an experiment. I'd encourage you to try it. What happens when we do this? The psalmist concludes or moves on. We become like trees planted by streams of water which yield their fruit in its season. Their leaves do not wither, and all that they do, they prosper. In other words, we become stable people. We become substantial people. We become rooted people. The kind of people that this world needs. That's who we become when we walk down this road. When we believe, behave, and belong in the family of God instead of in the family of those arrayed against God. But if we don't, if we choose a different path, we also choose a different destiny. When you get on I-5, you either head north or you head south, and which way you go determines where you wind up. To choose your path is to choose your destination. The wicked are not so, but are like chaff that the wind drives away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. Instead of being substantial, we become superficial. Instead of being stable, we become random and flighty. Instead of achieving success, we find destruction. That's not God's heart for you. It's not my heart for you. It's not even your heart for yourself. In fact, who would knowingly choose that? Really no one, in one sense. But it reminds me of a story I heard about Fallon, Nevada. Anybody been to Fallon, Nevada? Fallon is the arsenic capital of America. 2001 story in the Chicago Tribune tells us this tale. The Environmental Protection Agency found that Fallon's water system delivered more arsenic to its customers than any... Now, arsenic, you know, the stuff that kills people? Like, you ever seen the movie Arsenic and Old Lace? Arsenic, deadly poison. Delivers more deadly poison to its customers than any other large town water system. Folks there even joke about it. There's this, like, in-joke in town. Arsenic, it only bothers you if you're not used to it. No, it only kills you if you're too used to it. What's wrong with you? Tim Miller, who's lived in Fallon all his life, however short it was, jest, arsenic is no biggie. I'll die of something. It's called life. The minute you're born, you start dying. The arsenic levels remain high, to my knowledge, to this day. Not because the people there actively like drinking arsenic. They make jokes about it, but they're not thinking, oh boy, I got my vitamin C and my arsenic today. Yes! Now I'll grow up big and strong and dead. But because they don't want to pay for the $10 million treatment plant it will require. Said an official in the town, this is Nevada, where prostitution and gambling are legal. This is Nevada. They don't want to feel like government is intruding in their lives. Talking about sin with people, the way of the wicked often gets the same response. It's not that they actively like the arsenic. They like being driven by, you know, greed or envy or bitterness. Oh, I'm so happy that I've not been able to forgive my friend for that time she betrayed me. And I love staying up late at night thinking about it over and over and over again. That makes me so happy. People don't actually believe that, at least not people I know. I hope you don't have a roommate like that. That might be a weird quarter for you. Or it might be a weird quarter for your roommate, depending on which side of the shoe's on. But they don't, like the people of Fallon, who don't like the government telling them what to do, even if it's the right thing, a lot of people don't want anyone, even God, telling them what to do. And they don't want to pay the price that change will require. The price of humility. The price of perhaps embarrassment in front of your friends. For saying, I was wrong. And now I will do this instead. Tonight, you have a choice you can make. I'm assuming tonight that most of the people here, you came because you would consider yourself a Christian, an active follower of Christ, someone who trusts Him as your leader and your forgiver, and you desire to draw closer to Him. And that's why you came to this meeting. Perhaps you came tonight because you were invited by a friend and you're just curious about Christianity. Or you're not curious and you thought this was something else, like the Acts Committee. I apologize. Boy, you got more than you bargained for. I don't know where you're at, but you're on one of two roads. And the way to tell which road you're on is to figure out what you think about Jesus. You see, Jesus is God. And so to get to God means to go to Jesus. To say there's a way to God apart from Jesus is like saying there's a way to get to New York without going to New York. It's a logically inconsistent statement given the premise that Jesus is God. You may dispute that. We can talk about it later. But granted that premise, how you relate to Jesus determines everything in life. And it determines, ultimately, which road you're on. Tonight, if you've decided I'm not happy, or I am fundamentally okay, I've made the choice to pursue God, but I'm walking down the wrong road, I'm beginning to dabble. I'm beginning to listen to bad counsel. I'm beginning to associate with the wrong crowd. tonight, wherever you're at on that continuum, you've got a chance to turn around. The biblical word for that is metanoia, often translated repent. It simply means to do this. Turn 180 degrees. Go the other way on the road you're walking down. Tonight, I simply invite you to join me in prayer. I don't know what sort of tradition you were raised in. Some people, they do a thing where you never ask people to relate to what the person just said. You pretend like it didn't happen. You go out, you have coffee and donuts, and then you go home. Other people, like, there's this big emotional sort of game where, like, you know, all right, with every eye bowed and every head closed, or what do you know, I want you to raise your hand now, stand up, now come down, wherever you're, that's not my thing. So I don't know where you're at, but basically this is what I'm going to do. I'm simply going to ask you to bow your head and join me in prayer. And then I'm going to say a prayer that I'd like you to repeat in your heart, if it's meaningful to you. And if you mean it, God will hear it, and he will touch you. And I'd be happy to talk to you one-on-one later. Or if you came as a guest someone tonight, they'd be happy to talk to you as well. So just join me in prayer if you don't mind.